Last night, as I was sitting in the apartment, we were hit with the remains of Hurricane Opal. And the winds were blowing and the power was flashing on and off and the rain was coming down in buckets. And I thought that what I should be doing tonight is talking about The Tempest, which was Shakespeare's last play. But then, once the storm moved out, it was this giant mass of warm air that moved up from the Gulf. So that when I left Baltimore at about 2 o'clock this afternoon, it was 90 degrees. When the pilot of the plane said, we're landing in Minneapolis and the temperature is 48 degrees, I thought it was quite appropriate I was discussing The Winter's Tale tonight. But I have to admit, I got off the plane and got a few deep breaths of that somewhat cooler air, and my old Norwegian blood just began stirring, and it's pulsing through me now, so I'm ready to go. It is, and there is always to be here.
Once again,
to have the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite plays. I said at dinner tonight, and it is true that I like playing desert island games, and I'm often asked if I could only take one Shakespeare play, if I had to go to my desert island, which one would I take? And it's a tough question, but I suspect that as the boat was pulling out, I'd have to run back and get The Winter's Tale. It is it's long been a deep-seated love of mine. And it's interesting as well that I part of the attachment comes from the fact that the play taught me certain truths that I needed to know long before I ever became a Catholic. The critics may debate as to whether or not this is a Catholic play, or as to whether or not in it Shakespeare was giving voice to certain religious sentiments that he doesn't express quite so openly in other plays. They can debate all they want, but somewhere in my heart of hearts, I know this is a Catholic play because it's one of the things that shoved me down the road to Rome. Most particularly, and in terms of what the play is about, and now that you've seen the video, I'm sure you understand. The play answered a major question for me. And this was some years after I had first gotten to know it and had begun to recognize the truths of the Catholic faith and was beginning to think that perhaps the place I needed to be was inside the Catholic Church. But I've become convinced because I've seen a number of people convert over the years, and it seems to me that God always poses one last challenge, in a sense, that there is one last roadblock that you have to get over in order to finally come to the fullness of faith. And the stumbling block for my modern mind, for my 20th century mind, the one problem I had that I simply couldn't deal with in a logical way was the question of the resurrection of the body. There was almost every other doctrine of the faith that I could accede to, but for some reason, and who can understand the mystery of it, I wasn't quite sure I was going to be able to buy that one. And while I was debating this, two things happened. Book of Poetry came out by a former teacher of mine, a great poet, and at the end of it, he has a series of poems called 11 Addresses to the Lord. And in one of those 11 Addresses to the Lord, he has a line that reads, "And I believe in the resurrection appearances to Peter and Paul as firmly as I believe I sit in this blue chair," which was a glorious line and suddenly made the connection for me that the resurrection of the body may be something as practical and down to earth as sitting in a chair. It's real. It's there. It happened. It could indeed happen again. And then I remembered a debate that I used to have with this man in his office after class, and we would argue about which was the greatest Shakespeare play, and he would argue that it was The Tempest, and I would argue it was The Winter's Tale. It's the sort of debate that literary types have. It's quite enjoyable and actually educational in its way. But I remembered that, and I went back and reread the play, and it suddenly became clear to me that much of what is going on in the play, and indeed the moment toward which this whole artistic experience moves, was a clear statement by Shakespeare himself asserting his own belief in the bodily resurrection. No small thing. And that at the end of the play, he had devised this amazing scene, the greatest piece of stagecraft he ever came up with in his whole career. Overwhelming at the end because it's the only surprise he ever gave an audience. It's the only time in his entire career he withheld information from the audience. In all of his other plays, if there are twists and turns, if there are things happening, if there are confusions, if there are mistaken identities, if there are problems, the audience always knows about it. The characters in the play may not. But in this case, he withheld the single most important piece of plot information from the audience. And that is the fact that Hermione is not dead. And yet we don't know exactly where she is, where she's been, what has happened, and when that statue returns to life. When Leontes takes the hand and says, oh, she's warm, something miraculous has happened. And the play is moving us toward a common sense, down to earth, real, hard rock belief in what is a miracle, but a miracle in the same way that the incarnation of our Lord was a miracle and took place in an actual town, in an actual stable, at an actual moment in time. It's a reality. These things can happen in the world. It made a difference for me, and suddenly I realized, if Shakespeare believed, who am I not to believe? And made what I guess we could call an act of faith. And one can have a kind of sense of authority from a great poetic imagination that can lead one, and as it led me, to a much, much greater authority. And that is finally the authority of Rome itself. And here I stand before you, a Catholic. A Catholic. So I have no doubt about what the nature of this play is. But let me just point out to you, because this is the sort of thing you will encounter. I grabbed this off my shelf. I have a couple of different versions of it. I was looking over it again on the plane. And it's just astonishing the things these people say. This is a critic writing in the early 60s before they all went crazy. This man is comparatively sane to what's being done now. He's writing the introduction to this particular volume and talking about the way that critics read this play. There are in the other group, he says, in the other group are those Christian folk. Perhaps the ablest exponent was S.L. Bethell, who believed that Shakespeare in most of his work, but chiefly in these plays, the late plays, the romances, I'll discuss them in just a moment, was expounding Christian doctrine, especially that of redemption. The last plays do indeed deal with forgiveness and reconciliation, which are certainly Christian virtues, but Bethell's views are extravagant and meet with little support. The seeds of the insanity were sown long ago. Fact of the matter is, a critic writing an introduction to the play can simply dismiss it, and he launches into the mythic reading and the reading about nature itself is what heals, and it's there. Those things are there, but that's obviously not what the play is about. We can also point to small little things in the play that make very clear, in tiny ways, the author was sending signals. The four romances, the last four plays, written right at the close of his career, within about a 3-year time period, 1609 to 1612, are Shakespeare's final comments on the world in which he found himself, the world in which he lived. They're his final commentary on the life he had lived before he retired and went back to Stratford to live out his final days. He gave up playwriting and went back home. So he is obviously concerned with, as any writer would be at that point, summing things up. giving a last overall view. The romances are very curious in structure. The Winter's Tale is very typical of those plays, and I'll give you an overview of them in just a moment. But it's very clear that one aspect of them is that they tend to deal with religious ideas. They're in the plays. And perhaps the single greatest tragedy in all of English literature is that this greatest poet playwright, this greatest writer of them all, couldn't speak openly about his faith at any time when he was writing. What can we say? He was not a courageous man. What can we say? He went through a grave period of doubt. I believe that's recorded in the tragedies. He was raised in a Catholic home, grew up in a time of religious turmoil, had a fine mind, a questioning mind, and the tragedies are plays of doubt, but he comes through that and suddenly writes these miraculous plays at the end of his life, but he still can't speak openly. It was not possible to do so. In the same way that we have the record of his apparently receiving last rites at the time of his death, but even that was kept sort of a subtle secret because it would have been dangerous for his family. The Protestant minister who was living in Stratford, who wrote the letter to a friend in another village and said, with contempt, "Master Shakespeare died a papist." Horrifying thing for the poor Protestant preacher. It's mentioned in the letter. Some people knew it, but it obviously was not a big public event, but people knew it had happened. These plays contain in them signals, signs. If you're reading them from the proper perspective, you can see what's there, but it is all coming at us through what I would call the world of romance, of fairy tale. It's at a distance. He makes it work because these are plays that have great depth in them, but they have something of the wonder of childhood, and certain things don't need to be directly addressed. And at the same time, there are moments in them when he's giving little signals, little signs, so that those who are listening will know what he's about. I'm going to give you one tiny little example with, again, the ridiculous commentary from this editor, where in the end of Act 4, all of a sudden it's been revealed that Florizel is actually the prince. His father's furious with him. He's threatened to disown him. And the poor shepherd and the clown are terrified. They expect to be killed. And the shepherd is complaining that he's lived all this life, he's been a good man, he's tried to do what he can, and now he's coming to the end of it, and all he can expect is destruction. "I cannot speak, nor think, nor dare to know that which I know. Oh, sir, you have undone a man of 83 that thought to fill his grave in quiet. Yea, to die upon the bed my father died, to lie close by his honest bones. But now some hangman must put on my shroud and lay me where no priest shovels in dust." It's an image of being buried by the gallows, and anyone who was buried by the gallows did not get a proper Catholic burial. The editor makes the following comment. "In the Catholic pre-Reformation service, the priest put earth on the body, and it was enjoined that this should also be done by the priest in the Protestant liturgy of 1548, but that liturgy was changed in 1552, and orders were given that some other person standing by put the earth on the body. Some priests may have continued to do this office, but attenders at a funeral would not clearly remember who had done it. The shepherd is merely lamenting that he will not have a decent Christian burial." Nonsense, nonsense. In a time of religious turmoil, a small moment like that, signal, right out to the audience. Equivalent today of doing a film, and in the film we see a Catholic mass in which the priest is facing the altar, and those who are receiving the Eucharist come up and kneel and receive the Eucharist on the tongue. And in terms of what's going on, in terms of the debate, within the Catholic Church at this time, one might say it would send a little signal as to what kind of mass was being done and what the person making the film was talking about. Nobody would miss it. Catholics wouldn't miss it. They'd know what that was about. Okay? We have little signals like that in the play. He's sending out signals to his audience. This is Catholic stuff. And there's no mistaking it. But overall what we have, because this is not a religious tract, it's a work of art. We have a work of art that's designed in a very particular way, in an unusual way, in what I would call, what most often is called the romance. It's very difficult to identify. But I can give you a few clues as to what it is. The romance really began as a prose work. Prose writing became popular during this time, and there were many authors who wrote in prose and put out little stories. And the stories were adventure stories, and they were often called romances. And what it meant was that what drove the story was the plot. If we look back and think, if you think of the great tragedies that Shakespeare had already written in the early decade of the 17th century, and we move now to the latter part of that decade, we can see the shift away from those gigantic characters, Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, Macbeth. And we recognize early on that The Winter's Tale is not a character study in that way. We have echoes of some of those earlier characters. We have a king who banishes his daughter, Lear. We have a husband who becomes jealous, and out of this jealousy comes the destruction of his wife, Othello. We have a monarch who is troubled in his thoughts and has extended soliloquies, wondering about what's going on in the world around him and what he can trust and what he can't trust. Hamlet. Okay? We have the king and queen who, at least in the beginning of the play, are very much a couple. Very much a couple. Overseeing and welcoming another king into their home. Macbeth. Every one of the major tragedies is echoed as we begin this play. But we do not get the profound exploration of characters. What happens instead is that the story takes over. And the story takes precedence almost at once, and Shakespeare begins working out this elaborately constructed plot. It's the plot that's driving this play. That's one of the characteristics of a romance. The characters are not that deep. The plot is what's driving the work. We also have a mixture, more so than usual, of upper class characters and lower class characters shifting back and forth. And most particularly and most often, those lower class characters are in a country setting. We go off into a pastoral setting. There is an attraction to that world of nature, to that what's often called the green world, in which you escape from the court, you escape from the city, and you go back to nature which can heal. That's in this play. The romance also has fairy tale elements in it. It does go back to that world of myth or fairy tale. At the end of the play, we have a statue that comes to life. It's the Pygmalion Galatea story from Greek mythology. Earlier in the play, we have the servant that is told to take the baby out and abandon it in the woods. We've got Snow White. Okay? All the way through, we get these elements of fairy tale, these elements of myth that are working, and combined, oddly enough, with very realistic scenes. Autolycus, coming to the sheep shearing and stealing everybody's money and singing popular ballads of the day. Real, those ballads were songs that then would have been sung out on the street, that indeed would have been sold. I mean, Autolycus comes in, pretends to be the ballad seller. He's just doing it so he can pick pockets. But he's there selling the ballads in the same way the ballads would have been sold on the streets of London. Something they would have recognized. What's out in the countryside? And that festival would have been recognizable. The time of the sheep shearing. And song and dance and celebration. And then all of a sudden we're back in the court and we've got statues coming to life. And what the author doing is just tossing all of this into a great big mix and putting it all together. For a long while, the claim was made that the last four romances were so peculiar in nature because Shakespeare had grown old and senile and maybe had a stroke and didn't know what he was doing. That this commentary was actually made, that he had simply completely lost his powers, and as a result, he wrote these very messy plays at the end of his life, in which he was he didn't know what he was doing. He was just writing mere entertainments. What's interesting is we get something very, very similar in some music critics who in the latter 19th century wrote about those late Beethoven string quartets that were so peculiar and oddly structured because the poor man had gone deaf and he couldn't hear what he was putting down on paper. The critics, with their typical arrogance, assume that if there's something odd in the work, it's not that I don't understand it. There had to be a problem with the artist. Beware of critics at all times. The artists usually tend to know more, and it takes us a while to catch up with them, and now people are very well aware of the one thing the critics will not argue is that Shakespeare knew exactly what he was doing as he wrote these plays. They're very odd. They're not like other plays he wrote. He was in some ways experimenting, but it's not just experimental because he's in perfect control all the way through. But perhaps the most important element of the romance is that it tends toward what we call tragicomedy. This bizarre union of the two principal dramatic forms. From the time of the birth of drama with the Greeks, there have been two standard types of drama, the tragedy and the comedy. It was not until our own sad age that the two really got mushy, and now we have plays that you don't know what they are. You can't define them at all. So we usually just call them dramas because we don't know what they are. The two were clearly defined types. I want to just take a moment and define for you what those two types are and how they work, because they're important in understanding this play, because it is true what he is doing is putting the two together. And in this play, he puts them together in an extremely unusual way. He begins by giving us a mini tragedy and then follows it almost immediately with a fairly typical comedy. And then, having done that, in the final scene, we go shooting off somewhere. We're not quite sure where we are. We go someplace no playwright had ever taken any audience before. But before we get there, he has covered the ground of the two principal forms of drama. But I'm going to give them to you in reverse order from the way Shakespeare puts them in the play. Let me quickly define comedy for you. If the source of all drama is conflict, and it must be. It's what defines drama. It's an action on a stage in which there are characters or ideas coming into conflict. The conflict in a comedy is almost always social in nature. The conflict in comedy is a conflict between an individual and the society in which the individual lives. Comedy focuses very much on this world, and very much in terms of day-to-day lives and how we manage to live with each other. Put very simply, the pattern is this. Comedy begins with a conflict in which individual desire and the quest for individual happiness comes into conflict with a rigid social structure that has rigid laws and demands the subjugation of the individual to that society. Okay? The danger in comedy is either that social structure will become so rigid it will crush the individual and there is no chance for any kind of personal fulfillment in life. Or on the other hand, the individual will so willfully assert personal desire that the social order collapses. And comedy recognizes that both of these are disastrous, that there must be balance. Comedy leads that conflict to crisis and then reassures us by working the plot out and giving us at the end an emblem of compromise, renewal, and regeneration, where the individual desire is fulfilled in a socially acceptable way, and both benefit. The individual gets what he wants, and the society gets to maintain its order, and indeed have the individual subjugated to the social order. It's the reason why almost all great comedies end in marriage, because marriage is the perfect emblem of that. It is the individual finding the place in which all of those desires can be expressed. Desire can be fulfilled. There is that glorious sense of personal happiness. The guy gets the girl he wants. The girl gets the guy she wants. And simultaneously, the society has a structure that says, yes, indeed, come on in. We sanction this. This is great. And society gets what it wants. New little members of society. And there is a future. Okay? So you get this wonderful sense of compromise, renewal, regeneration. Boom. Everything works out. That is just the barest possible pattern, but you'll find if you hold it up to almost any comedy, the structure is there. It's working in that way. Tragedy does something extremely different, completely different. Tragedy focuses on a conflict that is not necessarily social in nature, but in which the individual is taking on forces outside of the normal confines of the world. I like to define it as the individual versus metaphysical reality. And the individual is fighting that which cannot be changed, that which cannot be compromised with, that in which in no way can be changed. And the individual is going to be crushed. Whether it be Oedipus taking on fate, whether it be Lear taking, well, Lear takes on the cosmos. In each case, the individual is taking on some huge, overwhelming force. And from the beginning, we know this isn't going to work. And not only is it going to work, there's going to be no way of getting out of this that isn't going to be unpleasant, which is why we usually watch. But the fact of the matter is, at some point, the individual makes a choice. You've heard this before. The tragic flaw. There is something wrong inside. For those of us who understand Catholic doctrine, tragedy has always given a sense of this. We know what that is. It's called original sin. There's that within the individual that simply will cause the individual to do something that should not be done. It's there. I'm particularly fascinated. I was just teaching Oedipus this past week to my plebes. Every time I read Oedipus Rex, I become more and more convinced that Sophocles was attempting to understand something about original sin. Oedipus, who has murdered his father, come and married his mother and had children with her, brought a plague and a curse on the city, and is now out looking for the murderer. Oedipus is the greatest detective story ever written. Because the detective, Oedipus, is out looking for the murderer of King Laius, and the murderer is Oedipus himself. The detective and the murderer are one. Only the detective doesn't know it. It's a brilliant plot. Best plot ever conceived. But the fact of the matter, what it turns on is there is a plague out there. Someone's done something horrible. We have to find out who it is. We have to find out who this corrupt individual is. And as the play goes on, it becomes clear, oh, it's me. Oh, wait. The problem's not out there. The problem's in here. This is where the guilt is. This is where the plague comes from. I'm the one that's wrecked everything. It's a fascinating vision. Well, that's typical. The tragic hero is somehow tainted. Tragic flaw is the traditional way of putting it. But it leads to a tragic decision. A tragic choice. And the individual is crushed. But in falling, in being destroyed, in losing everything, gains wisdom. Tragedy, from the dawn of the tragic pattern, has always said, through this suffering comes wisdom. Something that again comes as no shock to anyone who understands Catholic truth. But it is fascinating to go all the way back to the dawn of these notions and realize that I'm currently on a kind of Greek kick, having enormous respect for what these guys managed to do, not having been given the full light of the full truth. But boy, they were fighting their way towards some real understandings about the world they lived in. And out of it came some amazing things. And these patterns of comedy and tragedy are two of them. And they handed them on to us. And then a Christian mind such as Shakespeare's could come and develop them in a fullness, in a remarkable fullness, that connects very much with the truth that came to be known after the incarnation. Now, what we have, curiously, in the first part of the Winter's Tale is the tragic pattern. And it happens very quickly. This is a play that begins in such an abrupt manner that you are already sliding downhill before you know what's happened. But most peculiarly for Shakespeare, we are not given what usually happens in all the other great tragedies, and that is an external force that is somehow tempting the hero to fall. We can go all the way back to Julius Caesar, where Brutus is tempted to kill Caesar, and the temptation is personified in Cassius. And Cassius has this long scene where he convinces Brutus to join the conspiracy. We can go to Hamlet, and we have the tempter that appears on the battlements, and it's the ghost. The ghost saying, here's what you've got to do, and you must do it. Obviously in Othello, Iago, the grimmest and most frightening of them all, because you know he's everybody's college fraternity drinking buddy best friend. And he's the most malicious force ever unleashed. But an outside tempter leading him on. Macbeth, well, we know about her. Okay. and then that's in the natural realm. In the supernatural realm, there are those witches. There are those witches. Macbeth is tempted in both the supernatural and the natural realms. The only thing similar to what happens to Leontes is in the beginning of Lear. But there, Lear is tempted to give up his crown and break up the kingdom because he's old and tired. He's 80 years old. He wants to retire. It's a terrible mistake. He can't do it. He pays for it, but at least we understand where it's coming from. I'm not anywhere near that age yet, and boy, I'd be willing to give it up and retire. And there are days when I feel that old. And occasionally write up my letter that I'll turn in the next day, and, you know. Then I'll go off to the countryside and tend sheep and things like that. Lear has a reason. Leontes has no reason. Leontes has absolutely no reason. Out of nowhere, he goes nuts. It is unprepared for. There is no sign that it's coming. We've begun the play in a rather pleasant way. His best friend has visited him. They've had a good time together. He's trying to get him to stay. He suggests that his wife should also try to persuade the best friend to stay a little longer. This is all absolutely normal and understandable. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of this, he launches into this insanity, absolute insanity. Too hot. It's just, you know, to mingle friendship far is mingling bloods. I have tremor cordis on me. My heart dances, but not for joy. Not joy. And it comes out of nowhere. Almost. There is a little conversation that's gone on earlier that I think gives us a hint as to what indeed it is Shakespeare's getting at here, and the reason why he just hits us with it. In the course of the attempt to get Polixenes to stay on a little longer, we have simple chit-chat. And Hermione is saying, well, what were you two guys like when you were kids? And they're doing the typical things that happens when old friends get together. You're probably not old enough yet to do it, but it will happen soon enough. You see old friends and you say, it's the good old days talk. Oh, remember when wasn't it great back then? Oh, we had such a good time. And you remember the time that it was so wonderful back then. And Polixenes says, we were, fair queen, two lads that thought there was no more behind, but such a day tomorrow as today, and to be boy eternal. It's a vision of the innocence of youth. It's a vision of those glorious days. It's summer vacation. It's summer vacation when you go out and you're playing ball with your best friends. And it's June. August is never going to come. September is certainly never going to come, and you're never going to have to go back to school. And you'll play ball tomorrow, and you'll play ball the next day, and maybe on Thursday you'll go to the river and go inner tubing. Okay? And after you've done all that, it's still going to be the first week in June. We are talking about a vision of a kind of golden age. A time of innocence, of youth, of joy, that childhood once partook of. I say once. It's gone now. It's gone now. We've destroyed it for the kids. Sadly. But there was a time when it was a very real part of being alive and being human. And Polixenes is remembering that, and Hermione says, this is wonderful, she knows from the beginning. Was not my lord the very wag of the two? He's saying, oh, it was just, we were boys, and it was wonderful, and she's saying, yeah, you were scamps, weren't you? I know what you were. You were up to things, weren't you? You know, yes, you played ball, and you went inner tubing, but you stole those apples, didn't you, from the neighbor's tree, didn't you? Okay. She's aware, and she's saying, and wasn't he worse than you were? Wasn't that true? Polixenes, we were as twinned lambs that did frisk in the sun. No! No! Innocence. We were as twinned lambs that did frisk in the sun and bleat the one at the other. I love it. What we changed was innocence for innocence. We knew not the doctrine of ill-doing, nor dreamed that any did. We're talking prelapsary. We are talking a vision of humanity before the fall. Had we pursued that life, and our weak spirits ne'er been higher reared with stronger blood, we should have answered heaven boldly, not guilty. The imposition cleared hereditary ours. If we could have gotten rid of our original sin and stayed innocent youths like that before, and I love it, it's a nice phrase, before our weak spirits were higher reared with stronger blood, okay? Where the blood got going and we grew up, okay? If we had been able to do that and cleared ourselves of original sin, then we could have stood up boldly to the heaven and said, not guilty, okay? It's a big if, and it's an impossible if. But it is, again, a lovely little vision of what... And then we get... She's wonderful. This is one of Shakespeare... This woman is one of Shakespeare's greatest creations. And please notice, he's coming out of the period of the tragedy when he created some really unpleasant women. Goneril, Regan, Lady Macbeth, Volumnia, and Coriolanus. Okay, even Cleopatra, who's attractive but highly questionable. But this woman is delightful and glorious, although she's going to have to suffer. She's going to go through tremendous suffering, but there's no sign of it yet. If only we'd stayed that way, we could have stood up to heaven and said, not guilty. By this we gather you have tripped since. so wonderful. We lived before the fall. Oh yeah, but then you fell. Then you fell, didn't you? But please notice again, what have we got? Good humor. Good humor. An acknowledgement of, yes, that's what being human is. You grow up and you fall. We all, you know, went through that time and we all tripped since. It happens. Oh, my most sacred lady, temptations have since then been born us. born to us. For in those unfledged days was my wife a girl. Your precious self had then not crossed the eyes of my young playfellow. It's your fault. It's not our fault. It's your. We were fine until you women came along. It's Adam saying, my wife did give me and I did eat. It's her. It's Eve. I didn't do anything. It's Eve. Okay? It's a wonderful vision of the men would be fine if only the women hadn't been there to. And her response is, grace to boot. It's wonderful. By the way, the word grace appears in this play more than anywhere else in Shakespeare. Constantly. Okay? Of this make no conclusion, lest you say your queen and I are devils. Yet go on. The offenses we have made you do will answer. If you first sinned with us, and that with us you did continue fault, and that you slipped not with any but with us. If we were the only fault you made, if you only tripped with us, we'll take the blame because it's sanctioned. We're married. Okay? It's a perfect answer. It's a perfect answer. But it is indeed, notice, and it's magnificent. The little speech begins with grace to boot. One can live in the world. One can gain experience. One might call it tripping. One might come to know woman. But with God's grace and the blessings of one of the sacraments, it's called marriage. It's okay. It's all right. And she says quite openly, listen, if it's just your queen and yours truly, then we don't have to worry about it. Then it's fine. Now, it's a little back and forth. It's a little exchange. Except what we are talking about here at the beginning, and it's what the play is all about. The vision of innocence, the loss of innocence, but the way in which God's grace can flow to the world, and for those who are willing to do what God demands, requires, that grace will indeed sanctify life. It's a glorious vision. It's an absolutely glorious vision. Is he one yet? He'll stay, my Lord. At my request, he would not. Hermione, my dearest, thou never spokest to better purpose. Never, never but once. Then he says, well, when you agreed to marry me. That was the first time you spoke well. Second time is now, you're getting him to stay. First time, then didst thou utter, I am yours forever. And she says, 'tis grace indeed. Why, lo you now, I've spoke to the purpose twice. The one forever and a royal husband, the other for some while a friend. And it's absolutely true. She has her husband and she's convinced his friend to stay. And it's all fine, and all of a sudden, then we get too hot, too hot. Boom. He makes a huge fall. But what is that fall? What is the problem? Let me put it this way. There is no external evidence. There is nothing out there that really could lead to this. What we have is a mind that has suddenly become disordered. It's one of my favorite phrases now. It's on my tongue constantly. It's Sister Lucy talking about the modern problem, a diabolical disorientation of the mind, where suddenly what's in here, that which God gave us to reason with, we twist, we turn around, we turn it into something it is not, and all of a sudden, that is combined with an imagination that has become corrupt. After that vision of these two young boys playing in innocence, we see the mature man. And that maturity has an imagination that has become so corrupted, it can look on innocence and only see corruption. It is a horrifying vision of what the mind and the imagination is capable of when it turns in on itself. Or if you will, human reason, the human imagination, minus grace. Something has happened here. Leontes has cut himself off from something. But more importantly, please notice, let me put it this way. He is now defining reality according to what's in his head. There is no external reality. There is only what's in his head. We are moving toward a vision of the problem that exploded in the 16th century. When all of a sudden there was no external authority, there was no external reality, there was only what I feel, see, think in my own head. My own head is the beginning and end of all reality. I define the world, I define God, I define my own church, I define everything. We know where that comes from. To my mind, what we have at this moment is the beginning of clearly, Shakespeare's presentation of what Protestantism was going to lead to. What is faith? It's what I say it is. What does God want me to do? What I say that I'm going to do. I am my own priest. I am my own church. I am my own world. I am everything. And the danger is, what's in here? A corrupted imagination. Let me give two recent examples. What Shakespeare does is put innocence out there and show us the mind saying it's corrupt. We had the counterexample this week. Corruption out there and the mind saying innocence. It is the exact beginning of the Winter's Tale, only flip-flopped. It doesn't matter what external reality is, because external reality doesn't exist. All that exists is what I choose to define it as. And if I say he's not guilty, he's not guilty. Don't bother me with evidence. Don't give me, it doesn't matter. Don't bother me with blood. So his blood was at the scene of the crime, and the victim's blood was in his van, and the victim's blood was on his socks in his bedroom. Well, that doesn't matter. He was gone from this period of time and then was back at this period of time, and, well, that doesn't matter. There was a bloody glove dropped at the scene. Well, that doesn't matter.